I'm here with Sebastian Strangio, our Southeast Asia editor at The Diplomat, former editor at the Phnom Penh Post, and one of the leading journalists covering the region today. He's the author of In the Dragon's Shadow, a study of China's influence in Southeast Asia and Cambodia, from Pol Pot to Hun Sen and beyond, originally released in 2014 as Hun Sen's Cambodia and updated a few years ago. Sebastian, thanks so much for joining me. Great to finally have you on.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Awesome. We've talked about doing this for a while now, and for me, I had always sort of imagined bringing you on when the podcast timeline itself had got closer to the post-Pol Pot era, which I know is kind of your area of expertise when it comes to Cambodia. But as the wheel of history has a way of sort of keeping on spinning, we have some events at hand that I think I just thought was a really good opportunity for us to maybe have this chat now. We are recording this on the 27th of July or the 28th of July, depending on what time zone you're in. And the border tensions between Cambodia and Thailand have escalated significantly in just the last few days. So, as I said, great time to speak with someone of your expertise about this. Especially since if I'm being honest, most of what I know about Cambodia's modern political landscape does sort of stem from your work. So I'm really grateful you've made the time to speak with me among what I'm sure are some very high profile outlets at this time. And while we're definitely going to talk about the current crisis, this is a historical podcast, first and foremost. And what I thought we could I thought we could use this current event, which hopefully might find a solution quite soon, but we could use it as kind of a case study to explore some themes and forces of the more modern Cambodian history. So I was thinking we could begin with one of the key through lines of your reporting, Hun Sen. And just as it's hard to understand Cambodia's mid-20th century without inevitably talking about Sihanouk, it's basically equally as impossible to understand its recent history without talking about Hun Sen. So I think that's a good place to start. For those less familiar with this modern part of the story, how does Hun Sen go from joining the Khmer Rouge as a teenager in the late 60s to becoming the figure at the heart of Cambodia's politics for more than 3 decades, to the point where, you could use the phrase Hun Sen's Cambodia as the title of your book?
Well, it's obviously a long and complex story. I think if we wanted to talk about how Hun Sen, achieved his initial rise, I think we need to refer back to the Vietnamese invasion of Cambodia in late 1978, that succeeded in toppling the Khmer Rouge regime and replacing it with an administration of more pliant, ideologically aligned communists. So this group, or this Communist Party that was installed in January 1979 by the Vietnamese army, was made up of two main groups of Cambodian communists. There was Cambodian communists who traveled to Hanoi after the Geneva Conventions, and so these were people that were very, trained in the Vietnamese mold, and were kept in reserve in Vietnam. And then there were Cambodian communists who had joined the Khmer Rouge. Not all of them were ideologically committed communists, of course. I just use that as a shorthand. They and then subsequently defected. So Hun Sen was in the latter group. He defected from the Eastern Zone, where he was a mid-ranking military commander, to Vietnam in July, I believe, if my memory serves me, of 1977. Many other future leaders of Hun Sen's Cambodia also defected. Many of them later, Heng Samrin and Chia Sim, who, along with Hun Sen, were sort of the troika of the early phase of CPP rule. They both defected in 1978, and so you have an administration. Hun Sen comes up in an administration that is essentially guaranteed by a Vietnamese military occupying force, and he comes of political age under Vietnamese tutelage, and he's very, they the Vietnamese early on identify Hun Sen as somebody who could who would be who was willing to defend their interests and play by their rules. He was also someone who was very quick on the uptake, very good at public speaking, and someone who was very politically capable. So within the Vietnamese backed Cambodian administration of the 1980s, the People's Republic of Kampuchea, as it was officially termed, Hun Sen enjoyed a very rapid ascent. He was willing to do sort of the bidding of the Vietnamese occupying forces, which of course was something that opened him up to criticism. And this will probably, when we talk about the border dispute, this theme will probably come back. But being seen as doing Vietnam's bidding in Cambodian nationalist imaginings is obviously a very problematic thing, given the role that Vietnam plays, and the fears that many Cambodian nationalists have of Vietnam and its history of slow absorption of what were once Cambodian or Angkorian territories, particularly in the Mekong Delta, now in southern Vietnam. And then by the mid 1980s, by 1985, Hun Sen is appointed prime minister. He is after the death of Chan Si, who was his predecessor. That's a position that he essentially held until 2023, with a couple of small interregnums. I mean, that this so what we have in the 1980s is Hun Sen gradually solidifying his power and prestige within a system dominated by Vietnam, a socialist, communist political system. By 1991, with the signing of the Paris Peace Agreements, which aimed to bring the Cambodian civil war to an end, that civil war pitted Hun Sen's administration in Phnom Penh against three resistance factions, including what was left of the Khmer Rouge, that were based along the Thai border. The Paris Agreement seeks to bring that to an end. It lays the groundwork for a UN peacekeeping mission and elections under UN auspices that were held in 1993. And essentially, the agreement, translated the wartime enmities of the Phnom Penh government and the three resistance factions into an electoral competition. Hun Sen is now, as the leader of the People's Republic of Kampuchea, a regime that had sunk deep roots by 1991. It had a security force. It had a presence in every village in the country and controlled upward of 95% of Cambodia's territory. It was now faced the challenge of having to open itself up to electoral competition. This probably posed the most serious threat to Hun Sen's hold on power, the idea that resistance factions, including Phun Sen Pek, which was a royalist faction founded in the early 1980s, which of course was associated with Sihanouk and carried all of the prestige that came along with that. That posed a significant threat to the control of the CPP, which of course was called the Khmer People's Revolutionary Party, Kampuchean People's Revolutionary Party. I think the latter, through the 1980s, and then it changed its name in 1991 when communism became a bit passé. So, Hun Sen successfully manages to steer the CPP through the UN period to emerge victorious in the 1993 election through, fair means and foul. And then through the course of the 1990s, he manages to outmaneuver and then through military force, essentially militarily defeat Phun Sen Pek, which came in first in the 1993 election and with which he formed a coalition government from 93 until 98. But in July 1997, there was a, that was the point at which Hun Sen launched what is often described as a coup against his coalition partner. Probably not quite the right terminology, but essentially the CPP aligned military and security forces aligned with the CPP defeated security forces that were aligned with Phun Sen Pek and essentially removed the political any sort of military challenge to the CPP's power. And then from there, it's been an iterative process of either eliminating sources of opposition one by one, either through violence, which is, you know, has been used periodically, even though to a gradually lessening extent over time, and through the manipulation of the judiciary and the legal system in order to prescribe various opposition parties and force and pressure opponents into either defecting to the CPP and joining Hun Sen or fleeing abroad. And so, through all of this, of course, it's important to recognize that Hun Sen was also forced to contend with outside powers, particularly the Western governments that were committed to democratizing Cambodia and turning it into this success story of the post-Cold War era. But of course, with China's growing power from the late 1990s onwards, Hun Sen has come to rely more heavily on it, or he's come to acquire a political patron that does not require him to respect human rights treaties or to improve good governance. They give him aid without any questions asked, and that's reduced the influence of Western powers to influence the course of developments in Cambodia. And over the past decade, we've seen under with strong Chinese patronage, we've seen the country essentially revert to the authoritarianism of the 1980s. Obviously, no longer communist. It's not a one-party state in a de jure sense, as it once was, but it is effectively a one-party state where there are small opposition parties that serve to, maintain a facade of multi-party democracy, but everybody knows where power lies now. And Hun Sen, of course, stepped down, as I mentioned, in 2023. He handed power to his son, Hun Manet, but he still retains a huge amount of power behind the scenes. And as the current border crisis has illustrated, remains very much the locus of power inside the country. So I think we can still talk of Hun Sen's Cambodia as a construct, even though he's no longer occupying the prime ministership.
It's so interesting to hear you go through that history, and for those that have not read your first book already, it really is this masterful work at sort of bringing all of that to life. When I was reading it, and just hearing you go over it again, I was struck by the sort of parallels that come out of sort of a you look at the sort of 60s period with Sihanouk and using China on the one hand or US aid to sort of muddle through this time period, but constantly sort of switching between these greater powers and appeasing them in different ways and then telling them to go away at other times when it suits them. And just watching this last sort of 10 years and just seeing that same process, but obviously in different ways, but also not so different ways as well. It's a fascinating sort of parallel there. But I wonder, just on that point, do you have any sort of thoughts about how that process has mirrored itself almost, with Hun Sen instead of Sihanouk as a sort of comparison to Sihanouk's
Yeah, I
time in
mean,
power?
there is definitely a parallel in terms of foreign dependency and the need for foreign patrons and the manipulation of the expectations of foreign patrons. I mean, you arguably even see that under the Khmer Rouge with the Chinese government and the sort of Andrew Murtha's work talks a little bit about how, again, it was a similar process of the Chinese expecting the Khmer Rouge to do certain things that they've said they would do, but then didn't. And they used the Chinese for their own gain or for their own interests. And I think we see that both you're obviously a lot more well read on the pre-75 period, but it's clear to me that Sihanouk was in a very difficult Cold War context, was trying to maintain a similar sort of game with both the United States, China, the various powers of the time. I think, it's interesting to look at the differences. I mean, the Sihanouk was, I mean, the Cold War context and was Sihanouk's main, that was the thing he was dealing with and seeking to survive. And whereas in the post-Cold War era, you sort of have a democracy-building project that Hun Sen is threatened by. It's not so much, I mean, Sihanouk was really the threat of conflict engulfing him and leading to his downfall, which it eventually did in 1970. In the post-Cold War era, it's more in the context of political competition within Cambodia and Hun Sen's ability to, his desire and ability to blunt, to prevent Western powers from being able to influence that, and preventing opposition leaders from being able to harness Western democracy building energy, to their own ends and to his detriment. And but both were very good. I think Sihanouk ultimately was a hugely skilled politician, but the circumstances of the time were, for him, probably impossible to manage, really. Cambodia fell victim to the Cold War, and there was probably nothing that any Cambodian leader could do to keep it out of that, unfortunately. But in the post-Cold War era, I think Hun Sen has been very capable, as we've seen, in manipulating the expectations of foreign governments in order to maintain their support, while also achieving the resetting of Cambodian politics to a more into a more authoritarian mold. I think that, yeah, the shrugging off of Cambodia's special status, which it had in the eyes of a lot of foreign governments after 1991, this idea that Cambodia was a special democracy building project, and that we would, that it was intended to showcase a certain vision of the international order that emerged from the end of the Cold War. I think Hun Sen always resented both the political freedoms that UNTAC, the UN mission, created, because it allowed a lot of his former enemies to repaint themselves as legitimate political parties as well as civil society groups. He always resented the unleashing of those forces and the compromises that he had to make. And I think that at the soonest opportunity he could, he sought to curtail them.
Yeah, I think it is. It's probably one of my. I definitely noticed it with this latest conflict, where I noticed that I immediately went for that kind of historical lens and put everything within this. Well, I recently, I put out an episode, just sort of a half hour look at the history of and how we sort of got here, and my mind immediately went to these broad themes of Cambodian nationalism and Cambodian history and the idea of these powers on both sides, this anxiety that I think can be very readily under the surface of the Cambodian sort of political and perhaps even just regular psyche of this nibbling away kind of thing. But before we perhaps dive right into that, I also became acutely aware of my own shortcomings in knowing about Thai history, and Thai political history, certainly in the last sort of couple of decades. I'm wondering if you could, for me and for my listeners, to sort of slightly bring us up to speed with sort of the Thai aspect of this equation. I know perhaps some of the fundamentals down. They'll make a joke about how many coups there are, and there's a political churn, and I think even for sort of experts in Thai politics, there can still sort of be an opaqueness that can be sort of hard to penetrate. But I'm just wondering, because we'll be talking about this border dispute quite a bit. I'm wondering if you could, in even quite broad strokes, just bring my listeners up to speed on the essentials for Thai politics at the moment.
Yeah, as you say, it's a complicated story. I think the best place to start is with the struggle between Thaksin Shinawat, the former prime minister who ruled Thailand from 2001 to 2006 when he was overthrown in a coup, and the country's military conservative political establishment, which is closely clustered around the military and the institution of the monarchy. This group, for whatever reason, was very threatened by Thaksin's rise, and his two large election victories before his overthrow in 2006, and because Thaksin activated lower middle class and rural Thais who flocked to him. He had a very populist orientation. He introduced very cheap health care and other handouts that created a sense of real significant loyalty amongst this segment of the population, which had previously been kind of ignored by the conservative elites of the country, and predominantly Bangkok-based elites. And so, there's over the past really, nearly quarter century now, Thai politics has been dominated by this struggle between allies and proxies of Thaksin, because he was forced into self-exile in 2008, and he remained outside the country until 2023. And the conservative elites, and there's been this constant churn of Thaksin aligned governments, one of them led by his aunt, his sister Yingluck, which was overthrown in another coup in 2014. But even before that, there were other Thaksin allies who were removed from power by court rulings. And so there's been this sort of this has been the source of much of the instability. Now, behind this, of course, there are bigger questions about the desire for a true democratization of the Thai political system, and conservative elites who view politics as something that should be, or power that is something that should be in the hands of people who are, have a moral right to rule, and so this is the deeper equation in Thailand, which has underpinned this constant churn of political contestation. But yeah, so and I think it's important also to mention that just as Cambodia has its nationalist fears and anxieties, Thailand also does. And the interesting thing about Thailand is that, it claims Thai nationalists are very proud of the fact that their country was never formally colonized by European empires in the way that all of its neighbors were. It was the only nation in Southeast Asia not to be colonized. But Thailand did lose a lot of territory, and it was subject to bullying and pressure from the French and the British, who amputated parts of Thai territory over the course of the late 19th and early 20th centuries. And these lost territories have been have left anxieties of their own in Thailand. And so this it's been also very frequent that one way of undermining one's political opponents within Thailand is to associate them with the loss of Thai territory and to accuse them of failing to stand up to defend these sacred boundaries, the sacred boundaries of the geobody, as Tong Chai Winichakun famously described it. And so I think, you have also, so you've got a dynamic in the context of the Thaksin conservative fight. You also have a pattern in which the conservatives and the royalists that oppose Thaksin have accused him of failing to stand up to defend Thailand's borders. So the 2008 conflict over Prayvihear Temple, which followed UNESCO's listing of the temple as a World Heritage Site, and of course the temple was awarded to Cambodia in 1962 by the International Court of Justice, a ruling that the Thais have never accepted. That was used by Thaksin's opponents, or he was in exile at the time, but it was used to bring down a Thaksin-aligned government at the time. And there were similar agitations in the lead up to the coup that overthrew Yingluck Shinawatra in 2014. So, and again, we're seeing this play out. We're seeing Thaksin's opponents accuse the administration, this time led by his daughter, Pe Tongtan, of failing to take seriously the threats posed by Cambodia, and so they focused a lot on the close relationship that had previously existed between Hun Sen and Thaksin, which dates back to the Prayvihear crisis, when Hun Sen appointed Thaksin an economic advisor and welcomed him as well as other pro-Thaksin politicians to Phnom Penh. And so this, yes, so the opponents of the Thaksin aligned government have now used the border issue once again to try and undermine their hold on power and to bring them down. And so this is the broad strokes of the situation inside Thailand, which of course has many other complexities and layers. But just in the interest of time, I think that gives a pretty good rundown of the situation there.
Yeah, certainly. And I guess from a layperson's perspective, would the short end of that be, are we looking at two unstable governments in Cambodia and in Thailand? Is that sort of the general picture that people should understand before they sort of realize what's going on with this border dispute? Or is it more?
I think we're talking about two governments that have weak democratic legitimation. I think that's probably a better way of putting it. I mean, in the case of Cambodia, I don't think it's an unstable government, but I do think it's a government that has had to rely increasingly on force to solidify its power. And since the 2013 election, when Hun Sen came relatively close to defeat, failed to anticipate, a groundswell of desire for change, which the Cambodian National Rescue Party, since dissolved by the courts, managed to harness. And since then, like I mentioned to you earlier, with Chinese backing, Hun Sen's administration has dissolved the CNRP. It's dissolved the Candlelight Party, which was sort of intended as its successor. And it's gradually sort of eliminated sources of opposition. So the situation in Cambodia is not politically unstable in an immediate sense, although who knows what's going on beneath the surface. But it's certainly, there's a sense of a lack of legitimation. And I think, if to focus on Cambodia, one thing that Hun Sen's government has always struggled with is the perception that of its association with Vietnam. As I mentioned earlier, the fear that many Cambodians have of Vietnam as a nation that is seeking to has always had a desire to swallow Cambodia's territory. This is very deeply felt among the Cambodian population, and it's been one of the main lines of attack that Hun Sen's opponents have adopted over the years, to paint him as a puppet of Hanoi, and to argue that he's selling out Cambodian interests. And so this is, this has been something that Hun Sen has not been able to whip up, sentiment about. The Vietnamese border has been a sensitive issue for the CPP, but the Thai border, on the other hand, is a little bit more of an outlet where, the government is able to, to potentially to counter its lack of de democratic legitimacy. Taking a stand against Thai predation is something that can potentially attract, it can burnish the government's nationalistic credentials. And so I think that there's probably something like that going on now. If you see the Cambodian response to this crisis on social media, it's been pretty much everybody has been accusing Thailand of unprovoked aggression and echoing the government's talking points. Whether or not they support the government, many opposition members and members of civil society and journalists have been, adopting a very similar line.
Yeah, it's definitely something I've noticed, even from, I'm sure you probably have a bigger social media presence than I do, and more connections throughout that, but just through the meager presence that I've cultivated and the algorithms behind all that, even accounts that I presumed were mostly just about sharing very lovely things about Cambodia and food and sights and things like that have taken a hard line stance on this conflict. And
Cambodia's a victim. That's the only framing that people are willing to acknowledge. And there's been a lot of faulty reasoning as well. We're such a small, weak nation compared to Thailand. Why would we fire the first shot? Well, those two aren't mutually contradictory. It's very possible that you could start a fight and then, hope to benefit politically from it before it gets out of control. I mean, the question of who fired the first shot is more or less unresolved, I think, at this point, and I don't think we can speculate too much about that. But it's been remarkable to see the extent to which this, just about every Cambodian that I've seen on social media has adopted this very similar line that Cambodia is an innocent victim of Thai aggression. The Thais, of course, have mirrored that.
Exactly. I was going to say there's two separate binary timelines of this entire event. And perhaps because, but before we sort of get into the sort of responses around that, perhaps for the benefit of perhaps people that are listening to this in the distant future, when this conflict is all but a footnote, perhaps in one of Sebastian's future books. Perhaps it would be, perhaps it would be good just to perhaps do a brief kind of recap of how we have gotten to this point in late
Right.
July 2025.
So last year, the Thai and Cambodian governments announced that they were going to reopen negotiations over the overlapping claims area, which is an area in the Gulf of Thailand, which has also been disputed for many years between the two countries. This area supposedly contains deposits of oil and gas, and so resolving this overlapping claims area and coming up with some way to divide it or to jointly develop it would benefit both countries. You know, Thailand with a stagnant economy since COVID, Cambodia, in a similar situation. And so and the fact that you had, a Shinawatra government and a government led by Hun Sen's son in power in both countries, on the surface created pretty auspicious conditions for the negotiation of this overlapping claims area. But nearly immediately, as I mentioned before, according to the dynamic I outlined before, opponents of Thaksin and his daughter's administration immediately began claiming that resolving and negotiating this would lead to territorial losses to Cambodia. And so, in particular, the loss of Koh Kud, an island. I think it's Thailand's fourth largest island. You know, it's a very popular tourist destination in the Gulf of Thailand, which Cambodia has maintained a claim over on the basis of the 1907 boundary treaty between the two countries, which also is the source of the disputes in the land border. And so the nationalist tensions and frictions began over the maritime border. And then at some point earlier this year, they migrated to the land border too. And the first thing that I noticed was an incident in which a group of Cambodian soldiers and their families went to Tham Wun Thom Temple along the border. Like Prayvihear Temple, it's perched right on the escarpment of the Dangrek Mountains. They went up there and they began singing the Cambodian national anthem in front of a temple that is, nominally under Thai control at the moment. And this, of course, created a diplomatic incident. The videos of this incident went viral online, and the Thai government had to, made a formal diplomatic complaint to Phnom Penh. And then from that point, based on satellite imagery conducted by a researcher at the Australian Strategic Policy Institute, both sides began, particularly Cambodia, began enhancing their infrastructure in disputed parts of the border. And so this sort of continued through to, alongside negotiations between military commanders at the border. This proceeded through to May 28th, when there was a clash between Cambodian and Thai soldiers close to it's the Chong Bok area, close to the tri-border junction with Laos, so right in the eastern part of the border, which is undemarcated. There was a clash, an armed clash that left one Cambodian soldier dead. And at that point, things began to escalate. While the two sides continued to engage in de-escalatory talks, the ASPI analysis of satellite imagery shows that the Cambodians began surging strategic assets into the border area, and Thailand followed shortly thereafter. And so this created the conditions for the conflict. And then it really, I think, it's hard to know exactly what the trigger was. I think that what we have in mid-June, which considerably worsens the relationship between the two countries, is Hun Sen's decision to leak a phone call between he and Pe Tong Tan, the Thai Prime Minister, which showed her in a very bad light. Firstly, she appeared obsequious toward Hun Sen, referring to him as uncle and telling him that she would do whatever he wanted to resolve this crisis. She also is caught on tape criticizing a Thai military commander and accusing him of being aligned with her political enemies, which, of course, criticizing the military in Thailand is a very serious thing. So this call, which Hun Sen, which was leaked from the Cambodian side, most likely at Hun Sen's instigation, it effectively destroyed the trust between the two families, and led to, an acrimonious fallout between Thaksin and Hun Sen. It also led to calls for Pe Tong Tan to resign, which she resisted, but she has since been suspended from office by the Constitutional Court, which is investigating her ethical conduct during the leaked call. And we'll likely see her removed from office sooner or later. So she's now, serving as education minister, sorry, or culture minister, might be culture minister now, but she's suspended from office. And the deputy prime minister, Pumtan, has now taken over as acting prime minister. And then, of course, it's in this context that we have the outbreak of violence on the 24th of July. And both sides claim that the other started it. The Cambodians claim that, well, yeah, there's not really much more to say except that. But needless to say, fighting began at Tamwon Ton Temple, and then it quickly spread to other parts of the border. This was a day after a landmine explosion in the Chongbok area cost a Thai soldier his leg. And injured four other Thai soldiers. And there was a week before that had been another landmine explosion. And Thailand accused Cambodia of laying fresh mines, which the Cambodians denied vociferously, claiming that these were leftovers from the civil war of the 1980s. So yes, and after the clash on the morning of July 24th, fighting spread to numerous points along the border, along the Dangrik Mountains. And continued as of yesterday. The two sides will be meeting later today in Malaysia for ceasefire talks. So it's possible that by the time this podcast is released, the situation will be resolved, or at least a ceasefire will be in place. But that's more or less the timeline of the past, of the recent conflict.
Thank you so much for that, mate. And I was sort of watching you watch this to get a lot of my sort of information on this as it developed. I think it was about a month ago, you shared a tweet which paraphrases something along the lines of this would if this happened, this would be the dumbest war in modern Asian history. How close do you think, how is that prophecy coming out? Are we close to that, do you think?
Well, I'm close to war. I mean, look, now that they've started firing missiles and rockets at each other, or sorry, there's no missile, but yeah, rockets and artillery. I mean, it's a short step from that to open conflict. I mean, it is. Look, I was being slightly facetious, but it is an incredibly senseless war. The people, the 30 odd people who have lost their lives, in this conflict, is look, the we have two, politically insecure governments that have both taken steps to escalate this conflict, for their own political purposes, and now it's escaped their control and become an active conflict, and it's resulted in people's homes being destroyed, people being killed, and it's yeah, I mean, there's no reason why. The two sides can't simply negotiate these parcels of the border. But of course, I mean, in a sense, it's about much more than just the border and disputed territory. It touches on deep ideas of national identity in both countries, and very sense in and sensitivities about past humiliations and fear, really. And I think that that's something that is driving this, and it creates a resource for politicians to use. The sense of threat to the motherland is something that has been used to undermine, used by political constituencies within Thailand to undermine the current government. And within Cambodia, it's being used by the ruling party to solidify its own nationalist credentials. And I mean, it is unclear exactly what the Cambodian side, what Hun Sen's motivations are, both for leaking the recording last month, which precipitated the decline, the deterioration in the relationship with the Thai government, and certainly made conflict more likely. And also, according to the ASPI analysis of satellite imagery, Cambodia has taken more escalatory steps in terms of moving troops to the border and fortifying positions along the disputed border. So, exactly what it's a little bit puzzling as to what Hun Sen and what the Cambodian government has been aiming to achieve with this. One thing that's been notable is that Hun Sen, in both media, state media reporting or state adjacent media reporting, and on Hun Sen's Facebook page has been depicted as being the one in command. You know, there's photos of him in his war room. There's probably a room set aside in his villa in Phnom Penh, where he's seen, you know, these very propagandistic images of him, like with a magnifying glass, looking at big charts of the border. But there hasn't been much action on Hun Manet's Facebook page. It's been very clear that Hun Sen has been the one, you know, in charge of this situation and in command. And so it's a little bit puzzling. You know, at first, a lot of Cambodia watchers thought that perhaps this crisis would give Hun Manet a way of solidifying his own legacy. You know, it's been 2 years since he took office, but you know, it's struggling to he struggled a bit to emerge from his father's shadow, as you would expect after 38 years.
It's a big shadow.
Yeah, and of course, his father is unwilling to enter formal retirement. I mean, he continues to operate a parallel foreign policy from his office in the Senate, where he now serves as president, and continues to be active behind the scenes politically, domestically. So, you know, there's been talk of, you know, there's been a lot of potential theories offered. One theory is that the casino legalization bill that the Pe Tong Tan government was seeking to pass in order to revive the Thai tourism economy was a threat to the revenues of Cambodia's gaming sector, and that Hun Sen wanted to kill that bill. That's possible. It's also been alleged that, you know, Thailand, as things escalated through June, announced that it was taking steps to clamp down on online scamming operations within Cambodia, which it claimed, as the UN and many other observers have done, are enjoy the protection of elements within the Cambodian security establishment and are associated with leading Cambodian tycoons and business people. And so going after that, which has also included investigations of a senior Cambodian tycoon and CPP senator, Kok An, whom Thai officials have put out an arrest warrant for now, that this investigation going after a key source of patronage for the Cambodian state, i.e., you know, online scamming operations, is that also explains why Cambodia has escalated this conflict, partly to distract international attention from revelations of the Cambodian state's involvement in these operations, and also to sort of, you know, retaliate against Thailand for crossing that red line. It's probably a mix of all these different factors, and it's quite hard to say at the moment exactly, you know, exactly what it is. But needless to say, you know, the rally around the flag effect has been very marked inside Cambodia. As I mentioned before, the social media messaging from members of the opposition, from civil society groups, even those that are staunchly opposed to the CPP are echoing the government's arguments about Cambodian victimhood and how, you know, Cambodia just wants peace. Thailand is the aggressor and is invading Cambodia, you know, even as the evidence suggests that Cambodia probably took more escalatory steps in the lead up to the conflict on July 24th.
Well, I'm so glad that I've actually been able to have this chat with you because I've now, yeah, I this has sort of solidified some of the things that I'd been thinking, and the Thai side did seem to make more sense here. And well, I had this idea of this dispute and these temples and perhaps Priva here as the most prominent example of that, even though it hasn't been quite where everything has happened this time. But it almost seemed like this stage for Cambodia or Thailand to put on its nationalist performances for whatever reason might have been necessary. And then I was struck by trying to understand, but why as is it that they're both trying to use the stage at the same time? Is that the kind of metaphor that would make sense that this is not that this is escalating as opposed to de-escalating? And yeah, I've seen a lot of different theories out there about the Cambodian side and exactly what's going on there. But yeah, perhaps speculating now when we don't know all the facts won't make too much sense. But you've touched on it a few times, and yeah, we touched on it earlier. I did just want to sort of round this out by talking about yeah the response to this has been yeah quite remarkable. And for you as a journalist, and What do you trust? How have you sifted through even the news of the military engagements and what has happened? Like how have you been able to find the truth in the last few weeks?
Oh, it's been very hard. You can't really trust any of the Thai or Cambodian press. I mean, aside from maybe a handful of sources and journalists who are able to have a little bit more perspective. For the most part, people on both sides have uncritically adopted their government's position, whether they, believe that they are or not. Both sides have claimed themselves to be the victims of aggression. Both have sort of depict themselves as victims into sort of and it's I mean, in terms of reliable information, as I've mentioned several times already, the ASPI's analysis. I mean, that's actually the closest thing we have to an objective assessment of the movements of troops up leading up to the clash.
Sorry, is that that's an Australian think tank, or
Strategic
is it?
Policy Institute, a fellow called Nathan Reuser that works there.
Yeah,
He's
it's a
there.
great
He does
thread
their.
on X or Twitter.
Yeah,
Is that
he does their
the?
satellite analysis, and he went and looked at satellite maps and showed how different areas along the border were reinforced, leading up, by the Cambodian and Thais leading up to the clash. And he outlined what he believed to be a, essentially a timeline. And so that gives us a pretty good sense of which sides have done what when. But there hasn't been much. I mean, the Cambodian press mostly, because most of it is aligned with the government, not all, but most, it has been a combination of articles uncritically repeating the government's claim that Cambodia, referring to the Thai attacks as Thai acts of aggression, right? Which is not journalistic language unless you're quoting somebody. And also, booting up ChatGPT to create these very purple op-eds,
I was going to
sort
say
of talk
the number of
about,
op-eds has been
the number of op-eds just, denouncing Thailand and talking about, the Cambodia's cultural patrimony, and it's, again, the theme of victimhood has figured prominently. That's been very prominent as well. There's been decent reporting from a couple of outlets in Phnom Penh. Cambodia News is one that has sought to, report in a balanced way on these things, but it sort of, it's reported fairly well on the two governments' opposing positions, but yeah, it's been very hard to know. But I do think that, the more interesting question here is not so much who fired first. It's more just the dynamics, the political dynamics on both sides that incentivized, brinksmanship over this issue. On the Thai side, the Thai domestic instability and attempts to attack the Thaksin government. That struggle that I described before continuing to play out. And then on the Cambodian side, an attempt to rally the nation around the flag. Again, the theories of why the Cambodians are doing this is are many, and none of them individually has been fully convincing to me. Clearly Hun Sen is attempting, he's doing this for a reason. I think one can't also not discount, patriotic sentiment as well, on both sides. That adds an extra layer. Hun Sen is someone who I think in the past has been impulsive, and it potentially, that could be playing a role too. When you're not necessarily talking about rational, scheming actors on both sides, there are a lot of passions flying back and forth, and both nationalistic and personal in the case of the Thaksin Hun Sen relationship. So,
Yeah, I saw somewhere that he'd accused him of, or basically, perhaps in the same way that he leaked this phone call, he also said something like, "Oh, and I'm not even going to say what you were saying about the Thai monarchy because it's just too risky to
I
say,"
mean, it's
which is like
very.
the worst thing you could say about a Thai politician.
Yes, exactly. That happened after the leak. Hun Sen followed it up with several more claims that, that Thaksin had criticized the monarchy, which of course it's a very transparent effort to bring down his daughter's government. But again, for what goal? It's a bit unclear, Hun Sen claimed that he leaked the call after Petong Tan had called the Cambodian the Cambodian government like unprofessional or whatever in its dealings in the negotiations to resolve the border dispute. But I mean, that was a very minor thing to totally destroy the relationship over.
It
And
kind of begs
it's
the question of, yeah, what, well, I guess it is that theory of, yeah, is this some personal sort of vendetta as opposed
yeah.
to, yeah, like a rational
Yeah, I mean it,
political.
I might the leak of the call, my suspicion is that he did that to, in a context of growing border tensions, he did that in order to I mean, Thailand has a much bigger military than Cambodia. It's a much bigger economy. If there's an open, if there's a war, Thailand will win decisively and Cambodia stands to lose. But I think one advantage Cambodia has is its political stability, and it can, and I think leaking the call was a way of sort of, it was a form of asymmetric warfare against Thailand, insofar as it, he knew that he could destabilize the government and basically bring it down by doing that. It's, the broader aim or goal that he's seeking to achieve is unclear. If it's simply to bring down, the government in Thailand, he's probably succeeded at that. But any more conservative government that takes place will likely take a harder line on the border. So I don't know. It's sort of, it's still, I think, remains to be seen. But I mean, look, it could be as simple as wanting to rally the nation around the flag and solidify the nationalist credentials of a government that has increasingly had to resort to force to sustain itself, and in which there isn't sort of a democratic safety valve of regular elections, because elections now in Cambodia mean very little. They are not occasions when change is really on the ballot. And so, it could be that, initially there was, like I said, there, we speculated, some of us, that maybe it's, this is about giving Hun Manet a way of solidifying his own legacy. But the fact that they have not, that they've, that Hun Sen is being depicted as being the one in command sort of undermines that theory. And I guess we'll have to wait and see how this plays out. I suspect that probably Hun Sen is, has bet that this conflict can be resolved before it leads to open war, and that
Well, he
and
has an
that,
example for how long, what, 15 years ago, where.
the Prayvihear crisis in 2008 helped, the CPP rode that to an election victory that year, a very significant election victory. And then, yeah, I mean, the fact that they, again, like, given that the Vietnamese border is kind of off limits for the CPP, not entirely anymore, there, and I think that this is the broader context as well we need to look at. Hun Sen is increasingly enjoys Chinese backing. I think that the Prayvihear temple crisis, ASEAN's failure to intervene as Hun Sen requested during that crisis, I think disillusioned him about ASEAN, and reinforced his view that Cambodia needed a powerful friend who could, backstop its territorial integrity and sovereignty. And he got that with China. So now, Cambodia is in a position to more actively assert its interests against its neighbors than it has at any point in the past. And so while Vietnam has been mostly off the menu, using the Vietnamese border issue, and mobilizing nationalism against Vietnam, there have been a couple of things recently. The Funan Techo Canal project, which the Vietnamese have expressed a lot of concerns about, Cambodia has decided to push ahead with and said it doesn't matter what Vietnam thinks about it. The Manette administration also canceled the Cambodia-Laos-Vietnam Triangle Development Area, a fairly mundane economic integration initiative that dates back, I think, to the first decade of the 2000s. Opposition members started protesting that last year, and then the Manette administration, first of all, cracked down and arrested a whole bunch of people, but then they actually canceled the agreement. And so the government has shown an increased ability and willingness to stand up to Vietnam and assert Cambodia's interests vis-a-vis Vietnam. And this border crisis also shows an increased willingness to, push things a little bit with Thailand. And so perhaps, we're seeing a more emboldened, in terms of foreign policy, a more emboldened Cambodian position on these various issues. And so I'm sure that, like, that's a factor that may be contributing to Cambodia's policy toward this conflict.
And that's sort of like a beautiful circle here, because that's when we talk about this, I just can't help but hear, I'm thinking about Sihanouk in the 60s. Please just someone recognize our borders. Just every international conference he would set up or go to, this was his number one aim. And when it wasn't the North Vietnamese that didn't look like they were possibly going to do that, well, you know what? Maybe it's time to see what the Johnson administration will think about this now. Like it's, and then, as you mentioned before, with the ICJ case that sort of organized that awarded Cambodia the Priya Vihear Temple, and just it comes back to, I think, David Chandler. I'll paraphrase something along the lines of this is the theme of Cambodian history in the 20th century, particularly, which is just its neighbors, and it's, there's something to do with Vietnam. Well, perhaps there's something we need to do on the Thai border to balance. It's always about balancing these two and these competing sort of interests, even for the ruling party or the monarchy. And we could take that story back literally hundreds of
And
years.
the relationship with China too. I mean, Sihanouk
Exactly.
saw China as a way of keeping the jackals at bay. I think that's the word he used, particularly on the Vietnamese side. And of course, that's essentially what happens with the Khmer Rouge too. When the Khmer Rouge started massacring Vietnamese villagers, inside Vietnam, then Vietnam invaded to overthrow them, and then China invaded Vietnam in return as punishment for that. So, these dynamics are playing out again.
Or even and during the Democratic Kampuchea period, this whole using ASEAN, Ieng Sary cozying up to ASEAN nations like Thailand, even though it was a very conservative US-aligned government, just to say, hey, we're not the Vietnamese communists. We're, I think there's a famous quote there where he says we're revolutionaries and not communists, which is again showing, how far the Khmer Rouge were willing to lie about anything to get some help. But even there, I think it's Chu Chet. He's like a northern zone or northwestern zone head cadre. In his S21 confession, he's saying, "Oh yes, I've been in contact with the Thai army. We were planning an invasion through Priya Vihear." And it's the same story every 10, 20, 30 years, and we're
No, exactly. Again, both sides are victims. One thing that's quite interesting that's different on the Thai side is if you were to look at the Vietnam-Cambodia relationship, it's pretty asymmetric. The Cambodians are incredibly paranoid and suspicious of Vietnam, but you don't have that on the other side. There's almost a kind of, I think, a bemusement on the part of ordinary Vietnamese people as to how Cambodians view them. The interesting thing, because Cambodia's territorial claims were won by a Western colonial power, that fear and anxiety, the humiliation of those unequal treaties have been transferred onto Cambodia. So Thai nationalists, behind Cambodia's claims are memories of humiliation, past humiliations at the hands of much more powerful Western empires. And so it's interesting that even though Cambodia is an objectively much weaker nation that really shouldn't pose a threat to Thailand, it is, the Thai nationalists still have this sense of victimhood about that border and about the ICJ ruling and about the way that, the paranoia and threat about a neighbor that really poses no threat to them. And so, yeah, it's both sides have mirrored each other in a really interesting way. The Thai press as well. I mean, even just, something so basic as reporting where clashes have taken place. The Cambodian press will say Oe Domine Che province. The Thai press will say Surin province. Of course, this is an undemarcated border, or it's a, and we don't know exactly where the clashes took place. So the only thing you can do as a journalist is say that the clash took place along the border between Oe Domine Che province and Surin province. You can't say definitively which one it took place in. Of course, that's just echoing the government's line on these things. And yeah, it's been a little bit depressing how quickly people have reverted to nationalist, soldiers online when discussing this issue. Even foreigners based in Cambodia, I've noticed, are not journalists, but people who are sort of residents in Cambodia have sort of begun to sort of echo this line. I think probably subconsciously to a great extent.
Yeah, I've seen a lot of that as well. And I mean, I don't know, as we said earlier, it's become far too serious, and the fact that we're talking about multiple casualties and tens of thousands of people being relocated is just this sad reality of something that, like you, I don't think should have got to this point, and nor should it continue. And as you say, hopefully, literally in the hours after we conclude this discussion, hopefully, by the time this comes out, hopefully we'll be talking about this in much more of a past tense. But
Yes.
I did think it was a good good opportunity to have you on, a good opportunity to chat, and a case study, even if people are listening to this in the future, of how these themes, they don't go away, and they interact in very interesting ways. Also with, yeah, as you've mentioned, these very modern political aspects of this as well. It's a very interesting dynamic overall. But it's been a great chat, mate. And it's been an
Happy to
absolute
take
pleasure
part.
having you on finally. And I do hope, as I said earlier, once the podcast itself sort of gets into that, into the 80s and 90s, I'd love to have you on again, as well as do a bit of a deep dive on the Chinese modern relationship too.
I'd be happy to. That would be
But
great.
until then, I was thinking for people that want to read more of you, listen to more of what you're doing, otherwise get more of you, where should they go?
Well, I do most of my writing now for The Diplomat. So we're at thediplomat.com. We cover Asia Pacific from Afghanistan to the Pacific Islands, but I focus on Southeast Asia. So I've been writing a lot about the Cambodia Thailand conflict over the past, well, really since the start of the year when it's been, ongoing. But I write about all of Southeast Asia. I write regularly there, so you can check out my writing there. I have a website, sebastianstrangio.com. That is sort of dormant now in the sense that because it's I use it to showcase articles that I was writing when I was freelancing. But it has information about my books and a selection of my past articles and reporting from around the region. So that's another source as well.
It's an essential voice on, well, as you say, much more than just Cambodia, but for people interested in Cambodia, certainly pick up both of your books because they're essential reading. All
Oh,
right.
thanks. I
Thank you,
appreciate it.
everyone. And yeah, no, I'll talk to you again soon, man. Have a good one.
Yeah, same to you. Bye-bye.